Hello, I'm Anna Lee, an alcoholic.
Hi, Anna Lee.
Hello, and an Al-Anon double winner. Thank you for asking me to speak, Denise. Appreciate it. I'm grateful to have enough recovery to speak at something like this. So I have not had a hangover in 2,668 days, which is amazing because I had a hangover every day from age 19 to 2,668 days ago. I'm an English major, I can't do math. So I think the disease of alcoholism impairs my ability to give and receive love. I think we have receptors, and mine got bent in the childhood I grew up in. And the 12 steps helped me hammer those straight, you know? My mom's an untreated Al-Anon. My dad is an alcoholic who died of the disease about like 8 years ago. I think he was 53 or something. And I was born in Maine, and he moved back to Maine and died there. And I called the hospital where he died. No one told me for a month. And so I called the hospital to just get some details. I didn't know what he died of. I just heard he died. And the nurse sounded so insulted that I was calling so late, you know, and I thought, like, you know, I know she knows about alcoholism. You know, his body just gave out. He got pneumonia, and then, like, his liver failed, and, you know, I was just new in a different 12-step program, and, you know, I do know God's in charge of the bigger picture, because I so needed any spirituality to handle that, because, I mean, having an alcoholic father was fun, and it was, you know, he was very not there, and then eventually he really wasn't there. And that was a really, really big wound in my life that the 12 steps have helped me to repair, which is amazing to me. I remember sitting at my first adult children Al-Anon meeting and bawling in the front row and just thinking, or no, I guess I shared, I actually shared, and said, this is such a big tangle. I don't know how I would ever unravel this mess that's, you know, me in my head. And, you know, 7 years later, it's untangled. And I you know, in being asked to speak here, I had to reflect a bit, like, what was it like? It's been, you know, 2,668 days is 7 years and, like, 3 months or something. And I kind of forget what it was like, you know, which is amazing, because I thought I would always remember, you know. Things are good. Things are so different. But when I, before program, and, you know, age 13 till I started program and got recovered in program, the words I would use to describe myself were, you know, abandonment and unlovable. You know, that was me, which is a tough way to go through this world. And I was raised in a party. I mean, my dad, being anywhere with my dad was a party. He was a lot of fun, as many alcoholics are. But we moved in with my grandma, we moved to LA, and, you know, it was my grandma, me, my sister, the dog, my aunt, her son, you know, the friends for me. It was so many people, and it was dinner parties, and it was, like, big tables for dinner. And a big part of me getting sober was that it was really hard to be quiet, you know, be still, and not have everything be really exciting. And just like drugs, you know, the excitement had to get bigger and bigger. And I've met like heroes and rock stars and done fun stuff, but every new one had to be bigger. And so it was a real, like, I went through withdrawal when I got sober and had to just be quiet and be alone. I made some notes. So I started drinking at age 14. I was watching 21 Jump Street with Johnny Depp with my mom, and on Sundays we would drink margaritas. And I remember, like, getting drunk on tequila, probably, you know, like one margarita, but I loved the sunshine that, you know, I felt. And tequila is just bottled sunshine, in case you don't know that. But, you know, I was like, oh, I started drinking when I was 14, but I was like, wait, when I was 9, my dad, you know, smoked so much pot that the whole house was, like, hot-boxed, you know? There was, like, pot smoke at about my face level. And our house was, like, a big circle, you know? So, like, the air moved around, but so it was crazy. I'm sure I was high most of my childhood, actually. Of course I was. But I watched my dad roll so many joints that I, at age 9, could roll, like, a perfect joint. And people would be, like, struggling. I'd be like, give me that. And I'd steal his pot and roll pinners for people. You guys know what that is, real tight little joint. I haven't thought about this in so long. Because I don't like pot. I get crazy, crazy paranoid, and I can't talk, so I don't like it. So, you know, I think I'm a miracle in all the programs, but AA especially, because everybody in my family uses something. You know, the Al-Anons use their alcoholics because they make them crazy and they have a reason to be crazy. You make me crazy. You know, that's what, and I've said it to you, you know. But that is, like, when I think of my grandmother who's passed away and my mom, I hear, you make me crazy. That's them. And I'm like, that's how they live their lives. You know, my grandfather on my mom's side, total alcoholic, and just, you know, the pedigree. So it's a miracle to me because nobody in my family was like, Annalie, you need to get sober. Like, of course you use something. This world is crazy and people make you crazy. You know, but of course I wasn't earning my own living. You know, it was fine, but I had no money. I was taking my mom's money and, you know, getting into, like, credit card debt that she would pay off. And everything was fine, right? It's fine. Sure, it's fine. Went to college. Like, high school, you know, high school was, you know, schnapps and bonfires. And I would have to come home at night and kiss my mom before I went to bed because my curfew was like 10:30 p.m. when I was like a senior. My stepdad was like, let her stay out till 12. I was like, yes. So I would come home and go, like, breathe in and kiss my mom and, like, turn and knock over a lamp and be like, oh, you know, come home drunk. And so that was high school. And then I got to college, which was, college was awesome. I have always been an individual, and thinking back on that, it's kind of funny. You know, I've always had my own style, and, like, you would think that girl knows who she is, you know, like, by the way I dressed or, you know, shaved the side of my head or whatever. And the funny thing is I had no idea who I was, right? You know, I knew I was different or whatever, wanted to be different, I don't know, but college was helpful in that I got to just be away from my family and, you know, figure out who I was, which has taken, you know, 20 years. But in college, ecstasy was not illegal yet, and so there was a lot of that around, and we decided we would do acid and ecstasy together, which is called candy flipping, and it's so gnarly, you can't cross a road. You're like, how far away is that car? I'm just going to stay here. I don't need to go there. I'll just go home. And one week, I took a week off of school in the middle of school and decided to do speed with the locals, the kids who, like, lived in the college town but didn't go to school. And then one of the, so the, I don't know, there was, like, you know, we go through runs of, like, let's do a bunch of acid. Let's, you know, let's do a bunch of ecstasy. And then one of the last ecstasy pills I got was apparently cut with heroin, which I had not done. But somebody who was doing it with us was like, this is heroin, this is heroin. And I was like, ah. And the experience was so awful. Like, number one, everybody who was, there was about, like, 9 of us that all took the same pill. Like, we were partying. Oh, my God, we're on heroin. And everyone was like, we'd be hanging out, and then they'd run out into the front yard and just, like, dry heave for, like, 10 minutes and then come back inside. I mean, it was just like, ah, like, what is this nightmare? And I hate throwing up, which is ironic that I'm an alcoholic. And when people are, like, gagging around me, I'm just like, oh. I used to think, I'm not here, I'm not here, I'm not here. I mean, that, like, all the time, like, I'm not here, I'm not here. And so becoming present was obviously, like, a really long journey from I'm not here, I'm not here, to I'm here, I'm present. So after that heroin, I actually just was like, that's it, I'm done. I stopped doing drugs. But did not stop drinking Mickey's malt liquor, 40-ounce malt liquor. cheap stuff, yeah. And when I was 19, after my sophomore year, I believe, I went home for the summer, and the first night I was home, I threw up from not drinking, which I was like, ooh, that's not good. I know what that is. But that's all. That was the only thought. And I remember walking down Del Playa at UCSB, which is where I went to college, and had been drinking beer, was going to a party, and this was the night that beer went from a stimulant, like, oh, it's so fun to drink, yeah, to, like, a depressant. I was like, I was just walking down the street. I don't know what happened, but just this darkness went, came over me. And drinking wasn't quite ever the same after that. So like I said, about, like, you know, 4 years of drinking and having fun, and then the rest, the other 15 were the hard side of drinking. I remember when I would switch alcohols, like, I'm done with vodka, I'm gonna have gin now. I'm gonna drink champagne now. And gin is like the most evil alcohol ever. It makes me mean, and like I came home one night from being at a show and I was like talking to my roommates, I'm like, I know I'm slurring. I'm just gonna keep talking now. You know, I was just like, someone put me down. So I went to college in Santa Barbara for 4 years and then I moved to San Francisco. And I'd say that was some of the, like, the darkest time. I was so, not suicidal, but hurt-cidal. Like, I just wanted to hurt myself. And I would do things like, the Mission District is 3 miles from where I lived, and you have to go through Golden Gate Park to get there. I would just walk home from the bar. I would, like, take my wallet and, like, credit cards out of my purse and just put them, like, in my underwear, and then, so if someone wanted to steal my purse, they, you know, they would just take it. I totally expected that would happen, but I was so angry. I wanted someone to try it, like, just try it, and I will kill you. You know what I mean? I was like, just somebody give me something to take my rage out on. And I had a boyfriend at that time, and it's like, he was in the same state as I was. We were like two alcoholic disasters, and there was this one Christmas, we were like, let's stay here and celebrate together. Let's not go home to our families this Christmas. And my mom sent some presents, and we, of course, got some champagne to celebrate. And, you know, by 2 p.m., it was like crying and fighting and blah. And I have to say about that boyfriend was, you know, I did not think he was going to make it. And I lost track of him for a long time. And we found each other a couple years ago, and I was sober, and I was like, look, you have to get sober. Like, I'm not talking to you as a friend. I'm talking to you as a fellow right now. And he actually got sober. And I'm just like, if that dude can get sober, anyone can get sober. I didn't think he could do it. It's God is powerful. And Bryson knows him. He's a great friend now, which is so great because we get to, you know, look back fondly at, you know, what we were trying to do. You know, we were two people who, like, had walls up and pushed people away but needed to be with somebody, you know. It was very poetic. So after San Francisco, I moved to LA, and I was like, I'm gonna do things differently. I'm not gonna make the same mistakes I've been making that make me feel so bad about myself. You know, it's like by the time I moved to LA, somehow I got the little tape in my head that was like, you are horrible, you deserve every bad thing that's ever happened to you. You're horrible, you deserve every bad, that, like, constant, just nonstop. And I'm not here, I'm not here, I'm not here, I'm not here. And so I moved to LA, and then I did everything exactly the same as I was doing before that made me feel bad about myself, and I had no tools to do anything differently. I drove in blackouts, which I didn't realize. I was out, you know, at shows and stuff, and people would tell me later things I said. I was like, oh, I don't remember that. And kind of put together, like, oh my God, I'm doing things in blackouts. There was the I can't taste it phase. Here, bartender, more vodka, I can't taste it. I can't taste the vodka. And bartenders would, like, roll their eyes and, like, top it off and give me a dirty look, and I'd be like, thanks. Throwing up that night, you know, like, oh, God, I guess there was plenty of vodka in that. And I liked it when my eyes would burn, when they would get near my nose and mouth. So, like, obviously I had hangovers, and I've heard of alcoholic people that don't have hangovers, and I can't imagine what that's like. I don't know why you'd stop drinking. But I had, you know, I was like, for a long time I had the ritual to get rid of hangovers, you know, Pepto-Bismol in the fridge, right, a little nip off that bottle, ginger root pills, Advil, and I'd be like, okay. And at some point in San Francisco, it was like, and some vodka, and the hair of the dog, you know? That boyfriend, I would get out of bed, get us beer, and then come back and, like, give me beer while I was still in bed. It's amazing how well hair of the dog works. So, you know, I call that the crazy math, you know, like, Pepto-Bismol plus Advil plus ginger pills equals okay. And I'm like, never occurred to me to subtract alcohol. Never occurred to me, like, what if you didn't drink? Like, just didn't occur to me. And at some point, I was just like, well, I guess I'm just going to be hungover every day. I remember that day clearly, like, wow, I guess this is my life. And I had not heard about so many of the other 12-step programs. You know, AA is obviously, and Al-Anon is sort of out there in the world, but I was going to a therapist when I got to LA because I was miserable. And he was like, well, how much do you drink? I was like, I don't like 5 drinks a night. And he's like, well, maybe try not drinking. And I was like, okay. So I tried not drinking, and I was able to stop drinking, but wow, did I eat a lot. And I kind of ended up at a food program, which now, looking at it all, looking back, I'm like, wow, I started eating years before I started drinking. So I worked multiple programs, but I was so surprised how easy it was to stop drinking, and just because I was eating. But so I have a class, you know, well, I'm an alcoholic. I have the thing where I'm like, I'll work for a year, I'll take off a year, I'll work for a year, save a bunch of money, and fuck you, I'm out of here. And, you know, so I did that, of course. I also have to say, to my credit, I was kind of a mess, but I was also working as, like, a sort of a banking job, like a pretty high-pressure, high-money job, so I was able to, like, save money and be like, fuck you, I'm out of here. And I, you know, I've, like, bought some property, so I accomplished some big goals. So, you know, I don't want to sound like a total, you know, mess, because I was doing some things, but it was not easy. It was so hard, and I was so nauseous all the time. So I quit that job, I'm out of here. And I then needed a job a year later and ended up at a strip club as the door girl, I swear, door girl. I'm sure I would have danced if I had been skinnier. I was, like, 40 pounds heavier then, and which probably kept me out of some trouble. Although, the strip club ended up being the thing that got me to the bottom, which, of course, I'm grateful for. There was a couple times where I decided that financially it made more sense to bring my own bottle to bars or wherever, and, you know, like, why would I be paying, like, $7 for vodka and cranberry? I just buy a cranberry juice, put my own vodka in it. And, you know, you'd be in the bathroom, like, looking in the mirror going, this isn't what this looks like, you know. And clearly, I remember a couple times going, this isn't what it looks like to myself, you know. Just give me goosebumps. You know, just the denial. And I didn't know what else to do. I mean, that was, like, what I was taught. My dad, you know, taught me how to roll joints. He taught me you just drink through your life. So I was at the strip club for, like, a year and a half, and for a good year of that, I just drank and worked and took money, and the security guard was a member of the most dangerous gang in Los Angeles, and that was crazy. Him and 2 other guys all had crushes on me, and so I had these really dangerous people, like, wanting to date me and take me out, and you should buy a gun, here, let me take you shooting, here's my gun, and you're just like... what's interesting is I went out with just to a show with one of the leader, and all these guys had been like arrested for attempted murder. There was a big bust, and they'd all gone to jail. And I realized I'm at this club, and this, you know, this dude is all tough. Everyone knew who he was, and I felt so safe. I realized, you know, I was like, no one can hurt me with this guy here, and. You know, I'm glad I didn't get more involved with them, but I realized, like, when I was a kid, we lived in Maine, which is obviously quite, we lived in the country in Maine, which is very different from Los Angeles. Came to Los Angeles when I was 9, and the Night Stalker was in Los Angeles, people were poisoning Halloween candy, the crazy cat lady at the end of my block stole my cat, shaved it, and put it in a cage inside her house and said it was not my cat. And And you had to hold hands to go to the bathroom in my elementary school, you know, because people were getting kidnapped and you're not supposed to talk to strangers, and you sang the I'm Alive, Alert, Awake, Enthusiastic song when you're walking down the street. Like, just, okay, so I'm nine. I'm like, what is this place? And, you know, I realized, like, I'm scared. I live in Los Angeles. There's a certain amount of walls that you keep up. You're like, I don't talk to strangers. I don't pull over when people are like, hey, I have a question. You're like, no, I'm just, bye. I'm just going to keep driving. And, you know, it's like, I realized when I was standing with that guy feeling so safe that I was, how scared I am, was. So I started doing coke with a girl that came to the strip club. And, you know, being the addict, I just so quickly became, I've been doing it 6 nights a week. And, you know, being up till 10 a.m. and coming down till 10 a.m. and then sleeping for a few hours and getting up and going to the strip club again. And the crazy dude who was the security guard was also my drug dealer. So he sat next to me all night and we talked all night. And luckily, my character defect of vanity kicked in one evening when I woke up. And I had, like, crazy bags under my eyes, just, like, huge bags. My lips were orange. My lips were orange, like the weirdest color. And I was, you know, pale. And I was like, no, this is not okay. And the sad thing is I never even really did good coke. I did a lot of terrible coke and, you know, stuff where I'd snort it and be like, you know, like, and I went to my dealer. I was like, this is terrible. Do you have something else? And he would give me a better, you know, whatever. Coke definitely got me to the end, to the bottom faster. Who knows, maybe I would have been able to just keep drinking and not really hit the bottom. It's possible in my family. So, you know, I'm grateful for that time, and it was fun. I had a fun time, but it was also gross. I mean, I felt sick and wow. For those of you that have done coke, maybe you know, temporary insanity. I mean, I kind of came out of that like 4 months of doing it six days a week going, whoa, there's so many decisions I made and experiences I had that I would never choose to have. I'm like, oh my God. So, you know, insanity, like I'm really insane. So I was laying in bed and I would always keep the Christmas lights on so I couldn't really see when the sun was coming up because I was always like, oh, again, sunrise. And then this voice went, you never have to feel like that again. And I was like, huh, what, who's that? You know, it wasn't me, like why would I be thinking that? So I, you know, now I believe that was God, and I got up and wrote that on a post-it and stuck it on my mirror, and this one night I was hanging out with a stripper, and she was crazy. This girl was crazy and worked at a place named after people like her, and she was, like, really terrifying. There was, like, a crazy darkness around that girl, and she shot speed, and so we're hanging out, and I think we're like, what drug should we get? She's like, let's get speed, because that's what she liked to do. I hadn't, you know, I did speed once, but didn't really, like, even feel it. Like, so I had not much experience with speed. So she's in my bathroom shooting up speed, and I was like, I'll snort a bunch of speed, not knowing that you're supposed to snort less speed than coke, people. If you'll go out, snort less speed than coke. Seriously, I was up for 2 days, and I was like, is my heart supposed to hurt? Is this supposed to hurt right here? And the other speed people are like, oh no, that's bad. How much did you do? Show me with this line of salt. And I was like, this much. And this guy's like, oh. I was like, what? Like, what is that? And that night, you know, she was shooting up, and I opened my mouth to be like, shoot, you know, I was gonna say, like, can I have some? But luckily I didn't. And like in that moment, I was like suddenly above myself going, whoa, you're about to cross a line. That is a line I never intended to cross. Never intended to get anywhere near, and it scared me. Like, I was wasted, you know, but I was like, whoa, whoa. And you know, later that night, I was on the couch and just like, God, please don't let me die here, you know. We had gone now to her house, like, because her husband, who she was married to for I don't know what reason, would know what to do to help me, you know, which was just lay on the couch, try to sleep. Like, my heart hurts. Should I go to the hospital? No, no, no. You shouldn't. I'm like, are you sure? And because I was like, God, these people might cut me up if I die here and like put me in a bath of lime. I don't know that these people would, like, report my death to the police, you know? So, like, my mom would not understand this. So that was definitely, like, the moment of clarity, although it took, you know, probably a month, I think, for me to stop doing drugs. And I started going to AA meetings because I knew of them, but I couldn't, like, stop doing drugs right away. And then on April 14th, 2005, I just stopped drinking, stopped doing drugs, and, you know, I got sober working at a bar, strip club, and one day I was at that club drinking, the next day I was not. And when I think about that, I'm like, I think I could do anything, you know? Getting sober in a bar is pretty good. And I think it was helpful that I already believed in a higher power from my, you know, food program of a few years. I had been in a program for a few years. And my dad said, don't search for God, it's not worth it. And that was how I was raised. That was the spirituality I was raised with. And that was it. Said once, never again. No church, no, just not even any magic in our life. Just nothing about spirituality. And so, you know, I definitely struggled with a higher power when I got into that first 12-step program. And I'm sure it was very helpful to my sobriety that I didn't have to struggle with that when I was trying to get sober. And I do think that the old Annalee really did die on April, you know, 13th, 2005. I don't even think I look the same as I used to. And I'm completely not the same person. A big part of recovery was getting rid of ego. I have a lot of sponsees that are like, oh, they're going to tell so-and-so that such and such. I'm like, well, we have not gotten rid of your ego yet, because who cares? We're not in high school. You're a grown woman. And no one's going to tell anyone anything. Like, what? You know, and your ego is the only thing that gets hurt and that cares, you know? And getting rid of my ego and having a higher power, no one can hurt me, you know? And I used to be a house of cards. Like, please don't say the wrong thing. I will fall apart. And so what happened in sobriety is the life I was wanting from drinking and being out and partying was the life I was getting as a sober person, which was, you know, real friends, like being honest, like having a real conversation. And to this day, if someone's like, small talk, I'm like, can you just tell me something real? I don't want to have small talk. Yeah, it's boring. I don't have time for it. You know, it's like, just tell me something real. And like, it's a lot of the parties we go to are our program friends, and it's awesome because you have deep conversations and real conversations at parties. So, five and a half or six years ago, I was like, ooh, I need a career. I'm sober and taking money from my mom, and I'm a secretary for, you know, ever. And I am not earning well, like nothing wrong with secretary, but I was hitting a ceiling with the earning. So I was like, I'm gonna go to grad school. So I studied for the GRE. I took a week and just like went to an AA meeting in the morning at like 7 a.m. and then locked myself in my place and studied for hours, like, you know, a day. Took the test, did well. And then I got the job that I wanted to get because from going to grad school, I thought that you had to do it that way. And you know, that's just a reminder to me that I did the footwork and I was like, I'm doing this. And, you know, God was like, cool, I'll help you. Doesn't have to be so hard. And I was like, oh, that's crazy. And, you know, actually, I'm right there again. I'm like, oh, I want to go to grad school. And, you know, I would like to go to grad school someday. I'd like to get a master's. But I do remind myself, like, maybe the way I think it has to be done is not the way it has to be done. So, one of the other things about recovery that's been really huge is, I didn't even realize this till like 2 weeks ago, that I used to, you know, you hear some people say like, I was a chameleon, I was different people with different groups of people. And I was not that, but I realized that I would just not show parts of myself when I was with, you know, the rock and roll kids. They wouldn't see my whatever side, and my mom would not see like hardly any sides, and then bosses would only see the work side. And because I was always so afraid of bosses, terrified, and always like, am I saying the right thing? Oh my God, I said the wrong thing. And lately, in the last 5 years, I was willing to like show my whole self and all my talents to my current boss, and what that's actually given me responsibility, more income, respect, and, you know, my boss loves me, which is so different. I mean, I think people always liked me, but I feel like I have shown myself for real to people, and they really like me, which feels good. And then there's a lot of bitches at my work who, you know, don't like it when anyone's doing too good or whatever they're thinking. And, you know, I don't, like, put up a wall anymore. It's just like, well, whatever, you know, like, whatever. I'm not doing your job, you're not doing mine. Like, I don't care what you think. It doesn't matter to me. The people who pay me like what I do, and that's what matters to me. And then, you know, I realized when I started getting into a 12-step program, I kind of had words to talk to my mom and my sister, you know, the family members that aren't members of the 12-step programs, like, don't understand what you're talking about. You know, it's like, missing each other. So I started to open up to them and kind of tell the truth and explain things I would normally feel not safe telling them. And my mom's, like, a lovely woman, and she loves me, but she's an untreated Al-Anon, and she says things that hurt me, not on purpose, but it happens. And, you know, I think it's ironic. It's like my dad being an alcoholic and leaving was, like, such the pain of my life when I was younger. And then now being a bit older and looking back, I'm like, wow, my mom has hurt me so many times, you know, just being her untreated Al-Anon self. One of the things she did, which was awful, was that when I was when they were getting divorced, it makes sense to have emotions when your parents are getting divorced. She would, when I would be like expressing an emotion, whatever it was, it did come out as shoplifting, I will say, but but she would be like, "You're such a pill, you're hard to take." So like that's what I heard every time I had an emotion. "You're a bitch." And you know, I was like, oh, I'm not supposed to have those, I guess. I'll stop having emotions. And then my dad was like on the other end of the spectrum, the drunk, goofy, alcoholic, and lovey and blah, which I also hated. I'm like, ew, love, ew, being lovey, ugh, that's embarrassing. You know, oh, emotions, don't have those. Like, so, you know, that's a shitty situation. And where was I going with that? Well, that when I got into program, you guys have all seen that chart that's like happy faces and smiley faces and angry faces. It's like anger, fear, happiness, joy. I really had to be like, what is this emotion I'm feeling? What is this? Because they all came out as tears, you know, like happiness, love. It just all was like, ah! And then I realized my mom, you know, when I started like expressing love to my mom and giving her a nice Mother's Day card, she'll cry. And I don't want to make my mom cry. And I know it's like love and happiness and, you know, she's just like me. She's the child of an alcoholic, and I'm sure it's all overwhelming for her too. And yeah, I really just stopped giving my mom cards that were lovey, which, you know, I should start that again because, you know, I can handle it now, you know? The desire to drink has been so removed from me for years that I often think if I were to drink again, it would be because I forgot I don't drink. You know, I'd be like, oh, what's that? Oh my God, that's alcohol. You know, I do not think about it. And you know, obviously the program works if you work it. And I'm like having some health problems right now that just make me tired, and I can't. You know, it's cut into all the spiritual work I do, but I don't try this, but I'm going to a lot less meetings, I'm doing a lot less spiritual work, and I have no desire to drink. You know, it's still working. And, you know, we go to Al-Anon meetings every Sunday, and I have sponsees and stuff, but, I never figured I would test the waters with not going to as many meetings, but, you know, I'm go God. So one of the big things that changed my life, I had financial fear for a long time. It would keep me up at night. I call it the insane calculations. You know, you're like, okay, so I'll get that check on Friday, and then that can pay for the credit card bill, which, you know, you're just like this endless like math calculation that, you know, then the check doesn't, you know, it's just like insanity. And I really had to change the way I thought, right? I mean, I would lay in bed at night and go, you know, just money, money, money. And I didn't have money, which was the problem. And my mom taught me how to spend money, I will tell you that, but not how to earn money. I also didn't, she always uses her credit card, but one day, like last year, I was like, do you pay that off often? Like, how do you use credit cards? She's like, oh, I pay it off every month. I was like, I never knew that. Never knew that. So I would just charge up credit cards, and she would have to pay them off. And so I changed my thinking. A really powerful thing I read somewhere was like, the words that you speak create your life. And I started by like changing my thinking. You know, that whole like, you're a piece of shit, you deserve every bad thing that's happened to you, does not get you where you want to be in this life. So I tried not complaining in my head and then not complaining out my mouth. And you know, I notice in this country, this world we're in, it's normal to just be like, oh, it's so hot, oh, this weather. You know, I love the heat, but you know, just that like acceptable complaining, I just stopped doing that. And I really changed my life. I think the wrap up with this. So a big one for me is that the pain of my dad leaving, and then we were out of touch for 12 years, and then he died, right? That is a big hole that you have to work with in recovery. And you're like, he's dead. Well, how am I going to get better? You know, I can't talk to him. I can't do amends. But I did the things like, you know, write a letter, put it in the God box, and burn it, or, you know, whatever. And I'm amazed that things, my feelings about him got way better. But a huge thing I learned with that, like the willingness to turn and face the pain of being abandoned by my dad, who I loved, did not even really like my mom as a kid. I loved my dad. So he left and then left me with my mom. And I hope she doesn't hear this. And she won't. But I was amazed that when I turned to face the pain of my dad, which I actually see it as a big mountain, you know, for years and like a lifetime, I was going around it, and it never will end. If you're going around it, it will never end. It'll go on forever. But turning and facing it and then crying, and then, you know, God like digs a tunnel through the mountain, and you go through, I went through the pain. This is pain I thought would never end, and I can't believe how quickly it ended. Had I known, I would have faced that sooner. And, you know, doing the fourth step around my dad, I mean, it was like, you know, we had to do letters like A, B, C, D. It was like to Z and like double A, B, C. And when I was writing that fourth step, I was like throwing myself around my room. It hurt so bad. It was like an exorcism. I mean, and I really, you know, it is a demon. And I, you know, if someone was watching me, it would have looked insane. And that pain was so deep and so physical. I'm surprised that that's what my fourth step on my dad was like. Sorry, Bryson, forgot about you. He'll tell you all about us. But honestly, Bryson's patient and like consistent love has healed me in so many ways. You know, I know my mom loves me, but it feels conditional. And, you know, I tried to push Bryson away every way I knew how, every way I figured out as a 20-year alcoholic, and he just stayed and loved me. And that, you know, that's healed me. So thank you.
Thank you, Annalie. And now I would like to introduce our second speaker, Bryson.
Hey, I'm Bryson.
Hi, Bryson.
And I'm not an alcoholic. I'm a grateful member of Al-Anon. And it's always, you know, it's funny. It's always fun to speak, but we've never done this before, and it's kind of awesome to have Annalie here. It's also good to see everybody's face when she said, and I'm an alcoholic, because I'm sure sitting up here, you guys might have thought that was a switched around a little bit. maybe the other way. I haven't heard any of that, by the way. I've never heard your long pitch. It was awesome. I'm really rethinking this whole marriage thing. But and that's not true. because I'm an Al-Anon, so that shit just makes me love her more. Awesomely attractive. But I love you so much. I do. I do. And the thing that, you know, the thing that I want to open with is I've learned so much from the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I want to say that because, you know, we didn't have literature in Al-Anon when we started. You know, Lois and them started this thing. They worked the steps just like the alcoholics did. And they did that because they were all crazy, too. They realized that they were affected by the disease, and I'm affected by the disease. And what I found in my recovery is, I say this a lot, it's Al-Anon is the only program where they don't make you stop doing what kills you. You don't have to stop your bad behavior. If you go to AA, they're like, you're going to have to stop drinking if you're going to hang out with us. We will let you do whatever crazy stuff you're doing for life. And we love you and keep coming back. And that's okay. In my experience, that was not the best way to live. I had to learn to modify my behavior and stop doing those things that killed me. Stop making the choices, and I use that word a lot, the choices that put me where I was when I came into this program. And the daily spiritual connection with the program of AA is what really has kept me grounded. And I see that at my wife. You know, she reminds me to pray because she prays every day. You know, she reminds me to read because I see her read. You know, she reminds me of all those things because I get to watch that and I get to see the steps work in her life. I work the steps haltingly at best. I'm horrible with step work. When I do, I get amazing returns and I am healed. You know, and I'm fortunate to have in my life somebody who's there with me who will say, well, what does your sponsor say? You know, have you worked a step around that? And point me back to God. And that's something I really, really want to say, because that's something that, you know, she may claim that my patient, you know, love has healed her, but the truth is that her spiritual example keeps me grounded. Because for me, I forget, you know. We go to these meetings because we don't want to forget how left. It's like, just like, you know, for her, it's hard to remember. It's hard for me to remember what it was like before this program. You know, I've been over almost 11 years now, and my life has gotten really, really good. And so for me, you know, thank you to the committee and for having us here, because by telling these stories, I remember. And I remember that it could get bad really quickly. You know, and that's the thing. And it's been interesting to watch, you know, to see that and see that happen and go through. But for me, you know, participating in events like this always keeps me grounded. And anytime I'm of service, it's a blessing. So, you know, I'll start by saying that, you know, I grew up down south. And I, as an Al-Anon also, I tend to minimize things. And so part of my story is that I don't remember any abuse. I don't remember physical abuse. I don't remember sexual abuse. And so when people talk about the disease of alcoholism warping you or affecting you, for me, if I look back, it doesn't seem that bad. And I jokingly say, by California standards, there was no abuse. Or by Arkansas standards. But in California, they probably would have taken me away. But no, it's not really true. But I did find out that in my recovery, the things I remember when I work and do inventory, the things I remember that damaged me were the things that were said. And they were ideas that I got up and I picked up along the way. And I know that my parents are wonderful, wonderful people, and I love them both. And this program has given me my family back. You know, it's given me the ability to live in this world with other people, alcoholic and non-alcoholic. People who are not alcoholics drive me just as crazy. As an Al-Anon, I have this arrogance, and I'll use that word, ask your sponsor about it. I have arrogance, and I didn't know it was arrogance, but arrogance because I think I know how the world should go. I think I know better than all of you how this thing should all go down. And whether it's the decision on the salad dressing, or it is how we're going to get here, the directions we're going to take on the road, or whatever it is, I have this idea that I am right. And, you know, and my best thinking got me into church basements on every, you know, weekend. And so, you know, for me, part of the third step is maybe thinking that I might be wrong. And maybe there might be something that is more right than me, you know, and that's a big deal. Somebody was talking recently about they were going crazy because it was somebody in there. It was really funny. They were talking about someone in their yoga class that was like making noises next to them and how crazy it drove them. And I can remember coming to my first Al-Anon meetings, and if somebody was kicking a chair or chewing gum near me, I was like, murderous rage is the only the emotion I could describe it as. Murderous rage. How dare you make noise while I am in this meeting trying to get recovery and save my life? And I find now that you pretty much could set off a bomb in a meeting. And what I realize that is that for me, and I wouldn't notice it, but for me, that, you know, my head wants me to focus on anything but recovery. The disease has made it so that I will look to the bad. I will look for the negative. I will look for the distraction. I will not look for God and a program. And that's tough. So growing up, you know, my spirituality was really strange. You know, I grew up with a vengeful God. I grew up with a God of wrath. And then mixed in that, they were like, oh, and by the way, there's all this stuff about love. And so for me, it was like, you know, the sentence I say is I was taught that God loves you and wants to kill you. God loves you, and if you step out of line, he's going to kill you. And to me, that's a hard higher power to live with because I mess up a lot. Like my life was pretty much like one long screw up after another. And so how was I ever going to get love? You know, I was just going to get killed. There was no, that was thing. And for me, love was always very, very, very conditional. I did things to get love. If I was good in school, then everybody was cool and everybody loved me. And if I didn't, they weren't going to love me. My parents never said that to me. Central to me working the steps and doing inventory was me realizing that I had all these ideas that people had never said to me. I had somehow picked them up. Somehow this disease of being surrounded by this chaos or whatever, I had just gotten the wrong information. They say ours is a disease of perception, and my perceptions were largely wrong, largely warped and wrong, and it's the strangest thing. But so for me, you know, coming to Al-Anon, breaking the denial, was also about breaking the denial about myself. I had ideas about myself that were not right and didn't work in this world. So, you know, as a child, the way this stuff affected me was that I got this idea that I was not okay. Somehow, whatever I was doing was not all right. You know, and Anna Lee talks about that feeling that of that like it's not going to work out, and no matter what I do, and it's interesting that alcoholism seems to, like, I hear an alcoholic share, and I go, oh yeah, I thought I was unlovable, so I was always choosing somebody to be around me that wouldn't give me love, which of course meant that I never got love, which of course reinforced that cycle in my life. And that's something that for me, that you know, the literature talks about, you know, the dilemma of the alcoholic marriage. And so for me, as an Al-Anon, I needed those alcoholics because they were fulfilling this thing that I had going. That was the only way to do it. Who knows what would have happened if I'd actually been attracted to a normie. You know, like that was not ever going to happen. Like, you know, it was just going to work. So coming up, you know, pretty early on, I discarded any idea of God because God wasn't working for me. You know, I talk about the Saturday night God and Sunday morning God, and I had, you know, I just figured out that for me, I was not going to be able to use this thing they called God. And so, I started running the show. You know, I really respond to all the, you know, the AA literature when they talk about self-will run riot, because for me, I was running the show. And there's fear, you know, so much fear around that. Like, I have to figure it all out. I think that I'm not, you know, worthy of love and I'm somehow inferior, but yet I am running my show. And knowing that, well, of course that's terrifying. Of course fear was my main thing in my life, that terror. You talk about feeling safe. Yeah. I mean, I'm 5'8", 135 pounds on a good day, and I grew up in the South with, like, these crazy people, and here I look like, you know, some, at the time, I looked like some woman. I had crazy, goofy hair and everything, and it's like, of course, I was terrified, you know? And yet, again, I chose and put myself in that situation, you know? We laugh about it. We go to our home group in Hollywood, and we always talk about the, you know, like, the dilemma of the crazy, like, alcoholic Al-Anon punk rock kid, where it's like, don't look at me, don't look at me, look at me, look at me, what are you looking at, look at me, look at me, what are you looking at? It's like, I'm looking at your pierced face and blue mohawk. Like, that's what I'm looking at. You did that to yourself. I'm not wrong for looking at you. But that was the way I lived my life. There's just complete two opposite ideas operating in the same person at all times. And unbelievable, you know. And, you know, the egomaniac with low self-esteem, they always like to talk about. And so for me, you know, high school was not good. You know, I grew up surrounded by these big, huge rednecks that played sports and did all these things. And I had no way to, you know, no way to just find my way there. And you know, in our 20 questions in Al-Anon, we talk about, you know, not knowing who we are. And for me, I was a chameleon, whatever you wanted. To this day, it was like, today, we were like, they were like, and who's going first? I was like, well, I'm going to let her decide. That is a very Al-Anon thing. Nothing for me. Whatever. It's okay. Whatever's right for you. And that's a really horrible way to live your life. You know, needless, wantless. You know, I use that a lot. And in early recovery, I realized that I didn't know how to say what I liked. You know, one of the first things I realized in recovery, and this is really funny, I've now moved on from that, but in early recovery, one of the first things I said when I was working the fourth step was, I like frozen burritos. And that sounds so stupid to say, but it was huge for me just to say, I like frozen burritos. I like them. I do enjoy them. And now as I think of it, it kind of makes me sick. I don't actually like them. But at that moment, I liked them for that time. I was a bachelor at the time, not a lot happening. And I loved frozen burritos. But it was, I had never been able to say that. Like, to right now, I still probably couldn't tell you my favorite color. You know, there just was like no person, because it was whatever you like. And I surrounded myself and got whatever I had from other people. Oh, okay. All right, this weird sort of other people thing. And what I found was that when I was an adolescent, looking back, obviously none of this stuff was there at the time, I realized that, I felt bad about myself, so I wasn't ever really going to ask the girl out that I wanted to go out with. But I always, you know, wanted to have somebody there for some sort of other esteem. And what I found is that if I could find the more chaotic person, nobody was looking at me, you know, and I always looked better. And so I always surrounded myself, you know, lower companions, talking in AA about lower companions, like, oh, man, I think about it. And so for me, it just became sort of this series of ever lower companions, which drove my life further and further down. You know, a friend of mine wrote a song and she says, you know, I hit the bottom chasing after you. And that's the story of my Al-Anon story, is that, you know, my bottom was chasing other people. And I, you know, God bless the 12 steps, because, you know, figuring it out is not one of the 12 steps. I have no idea. I have no idea why that happened. I have no idea why this worked. But I trusted these people in these meetings enough to try it and to do the steps, you know, and I got better. And I get better constantly. When I work the steps, my life changes for the better. But, you know, I came to Los Angeles when I was about 21 years old. And fear, I just remember fear. You know, in recovery, probably a year in, I heard a guy in a meeting share that he used to have panic attacks. And you know, and we talk about fear. You read the big book, and it's all fear, and there's just so much about fear. But I never realized how extreme my fear would get. And I realized that, oh, wow, that weird control. You know, I was so scared. So I heard a guy share in a meeting one time that being in recovery had relieved him of his panic attacks. And he had panic attacks that the air in the room was going to, there's not going to be enough air, and he had to leave the room. And I realized, hearing that story, that, you know, I had panic attacks driving. And to give you an idea of the insanity, so I had panic attacks when I drove a car because of all the things that were out of my control. All these people on the road. If you want to face your powerlessness, you know, just get on the freeway, you know, and look around. It's all around you. There's your powerlessness. My reaction to that, because again, no God, no program, no answer. My answer was, I'll get a motorcycle because I can control a motorcycle better, right? For 8 years, I would not drive a car. So crazy to me. Looking back at it, at the time, it made perfect sense, you know? Like, thank God we have a program, we have sponsors, because you can be like, hey, I'm having this idea. And somebody can say, yeah, you should probably pray about that, or maybe should write about it. I realize now my sponsor doesn't really care if I pray or write or what. He just wants me to take a minute. Take a minute and run that by some other people. But that fear, that intense, crazy fear, you know, I responded to that in the literature when they talk about it. I'm like, oh, yeah, that's me. And I heard that in these rooms. And control, you know, control, man. I literally remember grabbing the wheel in people's cars and yanking it out of their hands, like that kind of crazy fear, which even that's crazy. And so for me, you know, I don't, this is sort of a weird thing. So my not drinking, two things. One, I'm really bad with alcohol. I'm physically just not set up to be an alcoholic. And what I love about real alcoholics is they just drink through that. You know, they just get through it. Like, I know my wife is not physically set up to be an alcoholic, but she, God bless her, she powered through and became an alcoholic. Bless your heart. And for me, I just, you know, I never could get over that hump, so to speak. And also, because I had all these crazy alcoholics around me and I had to feel better about myself, I needed to not drink so I could maintain my self-righteousness. So I jokingly say, I drink now like once every couple of years just to keep me from getting self-righteous, just so I can be like, hey, it's like, no, I at least have some compassion. But I don't have that allergy at all. You know, I don't have that desire that people talk about. But I do have that uncontrollable desire to control other people, to fix things for other people. You know, like, yeah, who sprang when the book messed up here? Who had their computer ready to hand them the big book? I'm not even in AA. How did I have the big book on my phone? Things like that. That's good Al-Anon right there. I need to call my sponsor about that. If I was really working this program, I'd have just sat there and watched him sweat. But that weird line between being of service. So, but God bless it. But no, so you know, it just got crazier and crazier. And I was out here actually for the heart to heart in the desert, and I started talking a little bit about, you know, I told the story about my bottom, and for me, it's really funny. You know, it's like, you know, I always tell, I say this every time because it sort of gives a lot about me. Also talks a lot, to me, it speaks to my, like, my ego and you know, and my thoughts of grandiosity and all that stuff. You know, as I got into my career and I made some money and I had some success and you know, and sort of, you know, started to find other ways to have esteem, because God knows I didn't have any self-esteem and I wasn't doing any really esteemable acts, at least in my mind. You know, I was able to kind of have a different life. And you know, I started to actually, you know, everybody, you know, if you grow up, you should tithe and you give back, you know, and this program's all about being of service. So for me, I was a big supporter of the arts. And that was something I was really, really about when I was right before I bottomed out. And I mostly supported dancers, and regular dancers weren't really enough for me, ballet or whatever, so I supported exotic dancers most of the time because I thought that was a better, should be exotic. Don't just have domestic dancers. And so, yeah, I spent a lot of time. It's such a miracle. I spent a lot of time at the very club she was the door girl at, and somehow we just missed each other. And it's so thing. We jokingly say that it's like, it would have been a great weekend back then. Like, it would have been an awesome, like 2002 or something. It had been like a rad weekend, but not really the basis probably for a marriage on either side. But for me, I did all the things we do. My favorite thing about denial is that, I was dating a girl that wasn't an alcoholic because she only drank when she worked. I'm not an alcoholic. And she only, she did some drugs, but she only did drugs when she worked. She worked 5 or 6 nights a week, may I add. And by the way, I'm sure she was high all the time. I just didn't want to see it. I didn't know. I wouldn't want to pay attention to it because I needed what I wanted to keep going. Like, my whole life was about what I wanted, like, and nothing for anybody else. And not only am I controlling as an Al-Anon, I was mean. You know, I was meaner. People say, I was a mean drunk. I was a mean sober. You know, I'm a mean Al-Anon, and I was thinking about it. You know, and because I'm small and physically I was never able to fight back, I learned to study and to be smart and to use words. And I learned to be deadly with those words. And I could make you feel so small and just reduce you to nothing. And so for me, my amends to this world is to become kinder, to become stronger as a man so I don't need to swing and strike out, you know. And I talk about that all the time, that big, powerful people don't hurt people. Big men don't swing on people. You know, big men don't beat up, you know, smaller people because they know they're not going to be hurt. For me, I was terrified. And any small injury elicited an outrageous reaction. I was going to swing back on you and strike out and hurt you. So there was no compassion for an alcoholic. Alcoholics were doing things to me. They were hurting me. Every action was, how could you do that to me? Here I am doing all this good stuff. By the way, no sight of all the horrible things that I was doing as an Al-Anon. So when I came in, broken down, sad, career in shambles, all my friends had run all my friends off. You know, my friends didn't want to hear from me anymore because I was always talking about them or her or whatever. I was exhausted. I had no time for myself or anyone else. I literally because everything that came to me, I had no filter. You know, in work, if a client wanted something, they got it. Nothing for me. Needless and wantless, right? Wantless, needless. That was it. That's a horrible way to run a business, right? Horrible way. Clients would call me and be like, hey, are you ever going to bill me? And my whole life was that. Everything for you, nothing for me. That fueled my resentment. It fueled my self-righteousness. You'd never had anything on me. And also, I had, you know, illusion of control. I was important. It was, okay, this is what I'm doing. I'm doing this for you. And I did it for alcoholics. I did it for organizations. You know, part of my Al-Anon, I say, I enabled corporations. You know, I enabled, you know, you talk about like not getting love back. You know what I mean? I was pouring my life and love into inanimate objects and organizations. Like that's how deep and crazy it was for me. So, didn't have direct alcoholism in my family that I could see. The truth is that there were alcoholics all around me. It's just, you know, we joke about it. It's like in the South, we don't have alcoholism. Oh, sure, there's drunks, but we don't have alcoholism. And there's very little recovery. Even to this day, I go back and it's so hard for me to see. I'm blessed to live where we are. We have an amazing recovery, you know, community. It was so great this morning having coffee and sitting in that cafe and hearing everyone as you walk by talking about recovery. And it was so amazing to me. And then to look out and see, it's like, we're, you know, the group, this, look at this group, we could not be more different. You know, every kind of person in here, every age of person here, every experience and background, and yet we have this one common thing. You know, somehow through these steps and these traditions, we can all come into this room and do this. And hopefully, you know, love each other and make each other's lives better. And in turn, maybe make the world a little better. So for me, I came in and I'm so lucky that I had, you know, two things that were very, one, that I had somebody that at least was using, because I'd lived my whole life not realizing that alcoholism was the issue. It's like you talk about, like you never thought of getting rid of alcohol. For me, I never thought of like, you know, getting a better class of person to surround myself with. It never occurred to me because I was so drawn to alcoholics, didn't understand it. You know, and for me, if you guys read Understanding Ourselves in our literature, the symptoms are really the symptoms of alcoholism. I believe that somehow, they say it's a family disease. I'm somehow affected by other people's alcoholism. I don't know how it works, but I have all, you read it, it's like obsession, guilt, anxiety. You run those down and read the big book, and it's like, oh yeah, that's what we're all talking about here. This is alcoholism. And that's also why the same steps work for us. You know, we changed a word. You know, so for us, it's like that. For me, I believe, I understand that this program is the answer to my problems. But I didn't, I didn't have any framework for that, but I had two blessings. One, I had this person that so I could maybe accept that she sometimes blacked out. And the other thing that I could, I could do is I had this amazing assistant around me, and she, she was a double winner. She was an alcoholic and she was an Al-Anon. And so the day that I just broke, she came in and wrote down on a piece of paper for me. I was just like, okay, here is Beverly is the person you're going to ask for, and you're going to go here to this church in Burbank, and you'll go there tonight at 8 o'clock, and just going to do that. And I don't know what it was, but I guess I just was so broken that I was like, okay, I'll go. And I was terrified. And I went in, I remember, it was kind of cold, and I had a big leather jacket on, and I had my head down, and I remember not even wanting to turn my phone off, because I was running the world so much that if my phone wasn't on, something horrible was going to happen in the world, right? Either my world was so fragile that if I didn't get that one phone call, it was all going to hell, right? Like, how little faith is that? I can't turn my phone off for an hour and a half. Actually, not even an hour and a half. Couldn't turn my phone off for 45 minutes because there's a break, right? I couldn't even get through that first 40 minutes of readings. But I remember sitting there and miserable and sad and just no way to live. And these little old ladies who I think were about 400 years old, I don't know how they lived that long, but they did. And they were like, two guys that I did not want what they had. What they had to me at the time was like slacks with high belts and like shiny loafer shoes and a haircut from like 1952. And I don't know, it's like so weird. I mean, that's how resistant I was though. All I saw was the differences, right? Like, oh yeah, these people have nothing for me. But after they talked, I heard something in every share. And it was just God, because I'm strong and self-willed and I'm smart. That was my weapon, and it's like, thank God this is a program that, not for smart people. I say that. It's like check my brain at the door, please, because my thinking is what got me here. So I sat there somehow and it sunk in, and I was like, okay, I'll do this again. And I'll share, quickly that I did it wrong. I went to one meeting a week. I would maybe read a book. I wasn't going to talk to anybody. I wasn't going to get a sponsor. I didn't even know what that was. I didn't really understand what you meant by work the steps. And lo and behold, it didn't work for me, right? I did that for 6 months or so. I started dating somebody in the meeting. That got a little awkward, and I was like, cool, I don't think I'll go to that meeting anymore. And there I was, released into the wild again with like 6 months of Al-Anon. Terrifying, like no recovery, but enough, ideas in my head to argue with you about everything. And about a year later, I came out to the desert with, and I tell the story at the same time. I came out to the desert with my gay sober friend, and when we went home, she, was no longer my friend. She wasn't acting gay, and she wasn't sober. And we started a really crazy, crazy, crazy dance. And even in her craziness, she was able to say, you're nuts, and you have to get some God in your life. And the only place that I guess, I've never actually said this, the only place that I ever really thought, oh, God, and I can relate to a God, was program. And I came back to Al-Anon. And it's huge to say, nobody shamed me. Nobody laughed at me. I walked back in that meeting with my tail between my legs a year later, probably in the same fucking leather jacket, head down, and that old guy with the belt up here walked up to me, and men shame me. That's my history. Men, like all you guys, you shame me. and you're going to make fun of me, and you're going to be rough with me, and I can't trust you, and that's my life. And this old guy walked up, John, walked up and said, hey, how you doing? And I said, good, but not good enough. And he said, I'm glad to see you. And that's all he said. Didn't fucking say where you been. He didn't say, why didn't you come to a meeting? Why don't you call me? He didn't say anything. He said, good, I'm glad to see you. And that, you know, that moment, I know he didn't even know he did it, but that second of love, that second of acceptance, and that second of non-judgment of me, you know, it rendered all those defenses useless. Couldn't argue against that guy. Can't argue against any man in this room. Every man in this room I know loves me. I don't know names. I know they love me. And that experience has been my experience of this program, you know. And Al-Anon tricked me. Unlovable, you know, unwanted, unloved, and alone. Like, that's one piece of literature I can quote. I'll say it over and over again. Unwanted, unloved, and alone. And that's how I walked into these rooms. And the people in these rooms, anonymity, allowed me to have nobody know what I did. They didn't know who I was. Nothing. I was Bryson. They didn't know me. They didn't know anything about me, and they loved me, and they gave me a hug every time they saw me, you know? And I related more and more to those people, and they tricked me because I would come in, and they loved me, and I was convinced that everyone knew more than me. And if they thought I was lovable, wow, maybe I am. Maybe I am. And I got a sponsor, and I went through those steps. And I got to that fourth step, you know, and I did it, and I read it to him. And when I finished, he said, you know, he didn't shame me. None of it came back on me. God bless him. You know, none of it came back in my face. None of it. He said, I'm proud of you. Good work. Me too. He said those things to me. And I, you know, and so I had the experience of having somebody who loved me, a man, you know, a big, strong, my sponsor is just such a badass. He's just so crazy. He's like a bodybuilder. He's, you know, a triathlete. He's a lawyer. It's like everything that should just make him crazy and terrifying. And yet he's wonderful. And he has full experience of his emotions. And he loved me. And that allowed me to go, okay. I've told somebody every horrible thing about me. And then they've made me look at every good thing about me. You know, because there is another half to that inventory. It's really important for Al-Anons. And at the end of that, okay, he loves me. I was honest with him, and he loves me. I'm honest with the people in my meeting, and they love me, right? So that cracked a door for me. And after I was ready, it's like, okay, well, cool. Now let's take that into the world. And I started going out to clients and just being honest and being who I was. And it was, lo and behold, they reacted positively, you know, and that worked. So weird. Honesty in this world worked. It was such a strange thing because, again, I wasn't scared anymore. And having a higher power, not being afraid, having something bigger than me running the show, it's no longer my deal. I can come in here. I don't know what I'm supposed to do. I just show up. She can go first. I'll go first. Whatever happens, I'll say anything I had because I'm just playing a part in this world now. God is running this thing. And so I showed up and then had this girl that I saw that it was my friend and you know, she's far too good for me and she's far too spiritual and she's far too wonderful to hang out with some crazy hippie like me, you know, and she probably has some really cool, amazing rockabilly guy that, you know, she sees or whatever. And my buddies in program were like, you know, ma'am, I think it's time for you to be honest with her. You need to ask her out. You know, I wouldn't ask that girl out. Never going to ask that girl out, right? Because I don't deserve good things. I only deserve the bad things. My buddies and my higher power now choose. And they're like, no, man, I think you should just ask her out. Because you're having feelings for her. You need to be honest. Oh, you need to not manipulate people, you know? I used to date people without them knowing that they were dating me, by the way. You know? Manipulation. That's manipulation. And, you know, and I ask her out, and turns out that she was sort of waiting for me to ask her out. It was pretty awesome, you know, and that's terrifying stuff, man. And I was honest with her. I took her out. I was joking before. I was in this ad hoc Al-Anon club called the Lonely Guy Volvo Club. That was about six of us that came into recovery, and we had our kind of like AA people, like our get sober cars. We were like, you know, we'd all run our lives in the ground, and I had this really ancient old Volvo. And you know, I didn't rent a car for our first date. I took her out in that car because that's who I was. That's who I am. And you know, and if she's gonna love me, she's gonna love me. And if she's not, she's not. You know, and maybe it's not supposed to be. You know, we're sitting here today. You know, I remember Scott, I'd see Scott Redmond, you know, share, and he had a tape, and I shared with him one time. I led with him in L.A., and, you know, and he said, I love my wife, and I said goodbye to her this morning, and if I never see her again, it's okay, and she's okay. It's like, you know, we have a higher power, and we understand that. That's a foreign concept for an Al-Anon, for an untreated Al-Anon. It's terrifying. Nothing can end. Everything has to go on forever, and we have to control it all. And so today, you know, I don't have control of this. And I didn't have control of that. And the dirty trick is when you're honest with somebody and they love you back, if you're really rigorously honest, you know, my old trick was if they knew me, they wouldn't love me. My sponsor ruined that for me because he knows me and he loves me. You guys hear all my crazy shit in these meetings and you still love me. You know, and my wife, I was honest with her about who I was, and she loved me. And so I don't ever get to play that game like, well, she doesn't really love me. She loves me, you know. And she also has a commitment because of her program to be rigorously honest. And I know she's here because she wants to be, not because of some weird obligation. That's a beautiful freedom, a beautiful thing. I never understood, could never understand that, you know. The most profound thing she's ever said to me, and it taught me so much, is that alcoholism blocks our ability to give and receive love. You know, and I fully believe that. I believe it. It breeds fear. It breeds all those things, and there's no love in that. And so for me, you know, replacing that fear with faith and with love has been a powerful thing. You know, I don't know how this works. I have no idea. But I know that, you know, I do what people say. I work the steps. You know, I read the literature. I sponsor people. I have a sponsor. You know, I say my prayers. I don't do it perfectly. You know, we are not saints. Thank God they threw that in. Thank God. Everything I ever saw that looked like this was like some kind of weird P90X workout that I was never going to complete. You know, it was never going to work. You know, but you know, I keep coming back and I keep doing the best I can. And even imperfectly, you know, this program works out perfectly. So I thank you guys so much. I love you so much. Thank you all.